Welcome to the MRI Cast. These podcasts focus on various current topics in MRI. We invite you to ask questions via the website and even suggest topics for future MRI Casts. The opinions expressed in these podcasts are those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect standards in clinical practices, nor should they be considered as medical advice. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to episode 31 of the MRI Cast. We are absolutely thrilled that we have a huge number of subscribers. I was checking today, we have nearly 29,000 people subscribing. And we want to thank you for being a part of our MRI Cast. And we also want to thank Bracco Diagnostics for their generous support with an unrestricted educational grant. Well, we have a really good MRI Cast for you today. Very interesting one, very timely. We're going to take a look at cardiac MRI in 2024. And we have a couple of really, really great guests with me. First off, a cardiologist. Yes, folks, a cardiologist. That's not a... It's actually a specialty, Dr. Bob Biederman. Bob, welcome.
Oh, welcome. Thank you very much. Yeah, it's great to be here again.
Well, Bob was telling me earlier, and we were getting set up and everything, that he was under the impression we were having, it was a video podcast, and I just want everybody to know that Bob dressed up for the occasion, and Bob, you've never sounded more impressive, I guess.
Yes, I've been told I have a face for radio.
Don't we all? And joining us also is the technologist that makes everything happen there, Ron Williams. Hello, Ron. Welcome.
Thank you.
So let's get started, shall we? And I want to ask both Bob and Ron. Ron, we'll start with you since I introduced Bob first. Let's start with you. What would you say has been the biggest advancement in cardiac MRI over the last, I don't know, 2 or 3 years, you know, whatever year period you've seen a lot of advancements?
For technologist part, I think all the new sequences, the mapping and stuff for cardiac MRI, it's helped make clinical decisions and changes in, you know, in people's medical treatment just because of what they may think. The results in cardiac MRI shows them it is something different. So it dramatically changes their physician's approach on what to do.
Have you seen anything in terms of, because we'll ask about the sequences, we'll talk about that in a minute, but have you seen anything from the data acquisition? I know what I've have been reading a lot about, that there's a lot of advancements in the rapid data acquisition techniques in terms of, you know, speed of acquisition.
They're all working on it. As you know, Bill, from your background, you may make things faster, but then you end up taking something a little bit away. Faster means you may truncate some of the cardiac acquisition. Mm-hmm. So you have to figure out a way to get all that, you know, get all that back, whether you have to go and, you know, catch part of the cardiac in one phase, and then come back and try to match up that phase to get the, you know, to get a nice data flow to give you the better cardiac image, be able to see the myocardium, and also to delineate the blood pool.
Bob, what would you say has been, what's struck you as the biggest advancement in the last few years?
Well, I would echo what Ron said, Bill. I think that the introduction of parametric mapping has been a game changer. And it's something that we have now incorporated into clinical practice. It's not FDA approved, but it certainly is an experimental aspect. It's something that we do on a daily basis. The ability to understand the limitations of late gadolinium enhancement from a visual standpoint have really been offset by the understanding of what ECV, extracellular volume, interstitial fibrosis is. So for the cardiomyopathies especially, it's very helpful. I think some of the things that Lon was getting at and you were getting at is compressed sensing approaches. So the rapid imaging where you're sampling K space in a truncated manner is exceptionally helpful. We did a lot of work on that in the block regional interpolated segmented case space with Dr. Mark Doyle. And those kind of approaches offer to solve some of the limitations that MRI has had, the throughput issues, the getting the patient in and out, and the efficiency of acquisitions while maintaining and preserving some of the temporal resolution aspects. I think those are very exciting. Lastly, I think real-time imaging for certain indications, why it's been a promise, is starting to become real. So we're seeing 50, 60, 70 millisecond acquisitions, which for a cardiologist, that aspect is critical for us.
Have you seen any, have either of you seen, or are you looking at any adaption of artificial intelligence based either in processing of the data or in the data acquisition realm?
So very, very interesting. I think that is our next hope and our next horizon. So I was at London at the SCMR meetings just three weeks ago, and there was a number of discussions and adaptations of that. My personal experience has been mostly in the post-processing. We're seeing a considerable amount of that. And so where Ron used to take 10, 15 minutes to do contouring, these are being done not just circle-less, contour-less, but these are being done using adapted AI and neural networks. And that is speeding up some of, for instance, the acquisitions, the post-processing of, say, of cardiac function to in the order of 8-10 seconds. You'd say, well, how can you do that and have reproducibility? I've tested this out a number of times, in fact, quite a lot since I first started working with that. And it is incredible. I can't draw contours reproducibly like they do. T1, T2 mapping, manually horrendous type of effort to draw these contours. These are being done in 8-10 seconds. So ostensibly AI is helping to move the post-processing. I don't think it'll be long before we start seeing it in the acquisition. But what I'm most excited about is in the analysis section or portion where the reports might, in fact, start having that. We've seen that in breast imaging. We've seen that in brain imaging. Mm-hmm. No, cardiac imaging is quite complicated, and that's difficult to develop those type of deep neural networks.
Well, Ron, that sounds like it's cutting into your coffee time, right? If you can't take 10 minutes to draw a contour, but I'm sure that does, all kidding aside, I'm sure that does help you from a standpoint of make you more effective and useful in other areas as opposed to sitting there drawing contours, correct?
The AI stuff is only good as the people that made it, but they still, when you get close to the base and stuff like that, they always seem to have more difficulty, you know, mm-hmm. picking out, you know, where the atrium is for the, you know, for the, say the right atrium and stuff, they'll end up contouring it instead of where it's up actually a little higher. So when you get up close to the base, the AI, I think, falters a little bit there, but like Bob said, they're really working on improving. When it gets to the point when it can replace me and especially replace Biederman, that's easier.
Yeah, that'll be another couple of 100 years.
Well, you know, there's always hope, Ron. There's always hope. Let's talk a little bit about a cardiac exam in general, because in at least in my experience, and certainly for me, my exposure experience to cardiac MRI is extremely ancient. And in fact, I remember when I was on a GE growing up in MRI, and you know, back then all we had was just what GE called GRASS, a gradient recall acquisition in a steady state. It really wasn't anything like the balanced gradient echoes or stuff that we have today. And cardiac acquisitions were, yeah, horrendous, 8-9 minutes or something like that, while you had to have a patient lie as still as they possibly can. And nothing against the cardiologist here, Bob, but when it first came out, we thought, well, great, let's let the cardiologist know we've got this capability and maybe it can help them out. Well, they only sent us the worst patients. Basically, they sent us the patients that they couldn't do anything else with. And, you know, worst patients with a, you know, 9-minute scan. So at any rate, my point is my exposure has been kind of low. And quite honestly, I know in speaking with technologists and certainly with the subscribers, there's probably a handful that have some experience with cardiac MRI. So I'd like to get you guys to talk about kind of the exam itself. First off, what would you say are the top clinical indications for MR cardiac studies? You know, this is the other thing. Maybe you can speak to this. You don't just do a cardiac MRI study. You do a cardiac MRI for a reason. Is that, would you agree with that? Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think that's a very fair statement. The trade-off is you're sort of implying is that there's a considerable number of sticks that you can swat at with different organs, different pathologies within the heart. So yes, if a viability case comes to us, we don't just do viability because the surgeon, the cardiologist, myself wants that integrated with, well, what's the size of the ventricle? What's the function? What's the right ventricle look like? What's the size of the left atrium? Is there mitral valve disease? And then if there's valve disease, can you semi-quantitate it, quantitate it? So these tests become quite very plastic, malleable. And so I'd love to just bring a patient in for just viability and be over and done in 20 minutes. But there's always additional questions. And even if the surgeon or the referring physician doesn't know he or she needs it, we add this and we make that part of it because those things have ancillary ramifications. If there's say severe mitral regurgitation and all you did was did a valve, does a surgeon know? Can he truly believe that? So these are phenomenal opportunities to do that. But yes, the number one indications I think have, if it's not cardiac function, which MRI does is really the gold standard since that really the UAB days in 1998, 1999, where I was training, it is going to be then viability, which has really since the early 2000s, with thanks to Ray Kim, Bob Judd, has become the sine qua non for imaging. After that, understanding cardiomyopathy, something we've spent a lot of our time doing, I think is the third most important decision. And now that there are, for instance, drugs for some of these restrictive cardiomyopathies, such as amyloid and hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, we're seeing not just a resurgence, but a considerable demand for non-ischemic evaluation for these patients, under the understanding that the ischemic considerations are really passe. We've done that for so long. We really have that worked out exceptionally well. And these new fields, although they're not new, we've been looking at them and published on those for two decades, are coming to the forefront.
Ron, from the technologist standpoint, you probably don't have, or maybe you can tell us, you probably don't have too much ambiguity of an order from a cardiologist or something like that. But do you get a lot of orders where you really have to kind of sort through exactly what is the clinical question we're trying to answer? Do you find that's a problem? I know that's a problem in MR occasionally as well, routine, but does that ever raise its head in cardiac?
Well, Bill, from a technologist standpoint, being like you, I've done all the other, all the other stuff, body parts, but I can honestly say cardiac is more involved. You have to understand the anatomy more. And most of all, I think from a technology side, when you get to work with somebody like Bob, all the years I put in with him, I had hair when I started. It's now gone. Yeah. Anyway.
Nothing's perfect.
I find that from a technology, that cardiac MRI is, to me, it's more enjoyable too. It's not intuitive. You may start out with a patient that come in for, say, hypertrophic cardiomyopathy, and you actually find out that, oh, crap, they got other stuff going on. So it's imperative and important that your technologist understands a decent knowledge of the anatomy. And be able to, for me, I go back to Bob. Bob allowed me to have a lot of freedom to basically do whatever views I wanted. If I questioned something, then I would tell him, he'd come up and go, well, why'd you do this? And, well, Bob, look here. Hey, Bob, look there. And so to me, it's important that, you know, from the technology, that you work with your doctor. Yeah, okay. And sometimes I worked against the Biederman, but yeah, we worked together.
Sounds a lot like the radiologist I grew up in MRI with. It's I think as a technologist, it's very rewarding when you can learn and, as you said, make an impact in a patient's life. And I think I would agree with you if you're doing the same thing day in, day out, you know, lumbar spine's a lumbar spine, you know, for the most part, cervical spine's a cervical spine, elbow. Well, I'm going to start to say elbow's an elbow, but you can't ever get them in the magnum. Mm-hmm. But it's, you know, it's, there was a joke I heard about, I had done some consulting with a VA hospital or for a group that works with the VA. And somebody made the statement, he says, well, if you've seen one VA, you've seen one VA. And I think from cardiac MRI, it can almost be the same thing. If you've seen one cardiac MRI exam, you've seen one cardiac MRI exam. You know, this sounds like they, you know, well, it's a very fluid type of scenario.
Well, Bill, that's where I'm going to disagree with you.
Okay, great. That's what I like to hear.
Every time each patient comes in, and this goes back, you know, to Bob's training and stuff like that, we're required to actually review the patient's chart the day before, look at the echo report, and then go through some of the notes to see what actually is a doctor looking for. Are they looking for myopericarditis, or are they looking just for valvular disease? And that helps get you into the right frame of mind. And, you know, sometimes you look at it and you might try to focus on something, but going back to my many millennium years ago when I started out in X-ray, a radiologist told me, he says, you have to look at the whole picture. If you focus just on what's in front of you, you're going to miss what actually is wrong with the patient. So,
So I think Bill is agreeing with you that he's not disagreeing. That this requires a smart, shrewd technologist. They look at the charts ahead of time. And I can count once a week, twice, three times a week, where the diagnosis will come in as one thing and we'll see something else. And if the technologist isn't there paying attention, isn't shrewd and understanding, then they just do what the study was about. They'll miss the diagnosis. I mean, how many times do we see an amyloid case become hypertrophic, vice versa, sarcoid case be an ARVD case? Ron has made some incredible observations even before I can get there, and he and I are in the room at the same time. So this is a prime opportunity for a technologist who cares, who really wants to be focused on being the best they can. I'm not a neurologist, I'm not an orthopedist. So I can't imagine that doing those day in and day out become that exciting, because they're, as you kind of imply, they're almost the same thing. But cardiology, you've seen one heart, that's what you've seen. I love that analogy.
Well, yeah, and that's what I was meaning. It's not that, you know, every heart's done the same. It's just you've seen one case, and every case is different. It reminds me, before I got into MRI, and actually when I first got into X-ray training, which is back in the middle of 1970, well, really none of your business. But when I got into X-ray in my senior year, I wound up in the angio room. And back then in the 70s, you did diagnostic angios. And I loved it because every day was different. Every case was different. If I weren't doing MRI, I would want to go back and do angio. Now it's interventional, or maybe even cardiac, because I think it's a... I love the deal where it's never the same. You know, there's no one patient the same.
Well, can't agree more.
Yeah, I agree with you, Bill. I mean, back I'm gonna date myself. Back in the 70s when I did X-ray and all that, but I was fortunate.
1970, right?
You don't want to, I'm not going to go into age factors here. Anyway, I was fortunate where, not because the senior technologists were lazy, it's just that they, when you're a student, let's face it, you're the grunt and you get everything. And I look back now and I was fortunate because I remember the first time I thought I was going to wet myself. I got handed two cassettes and was told to go to the OR.
Yeah.
And I said, well, are you coming to the tech? He goes, there's the door. I'll see you in about a half hour. So, and
yeah, that was my first surgical case was they said, we need you to go over to surgery for kidneys, something kidney.
Yeah.
I said, okay.
They told me to find fallopian tubes, right?
Right, yeah. Sterile fallopian tubes. So they sent me over to the surgery, and I walk in there and I go, I'm here for the kidney. And they turned around and they held it out on a towel for me. It was actually a kidney. And you know, those were fun times. But, you know, my point is that's the big thing I think that I want a lot of the people listening to understand, that cardiac MRI is not like, I don't think it's like any of the other types of studies. It really, obviously, it's got to be tailored. And like anything that's tailored, the person doing the tailoring needs to know what they're doing, so that you can answer the questions and then, as you point out, answer questions that people don't know that they're there.
It started back when Bob, for me, I if I see something, I made our sheet where we do our measurements on for the doctors, and then we'd put them into Epic and all that, and they review them. But on the bottom of the page, I have a where I write what I see. And then that's my way of getting feedback. And it also helps the cardiology fellows that are happen to be, that's their month in cardiac MRI, to look at the images and see if they can see what I'm seeing.
Let me ask you this, because this is something I actually don't know. I have a feeling I may know, but I won't be surprised if I'm wrong or don't know. Is there any particular patient prep for cardiac exam or any particular component or type of cardiac exam or component of a cardiac? Is there any patient prep?
Yeah, it's standard. You have to prep the chest and all the, you know, you think, well, EKG goes, you know, across the chest and all that. It doesn't. It's all localized, unless they have dextrocardia, but it's located on the left side of the chest wall. So you're actually keeping all your leads over there to form your triangle. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a male and you have to shave him, and as our nurse now has favorite joke is to a patient comes in and they're real hairy is, are you the first generation to walk upright?
Okay. Yeah, they wouldn't be asking me that, but then again, there ain't no grass on a playground, you know?
Yeah, we have to prep them. We have, shavers up. We get all the hair out of the way, so we can get a prep. We have what they call a prep gel, skin gel, so it roughs the skin up a little bit, so you can get a good EKG contact. And for us, once we get the EKG, we do blood pressure, pulse ox on every patient, and we don't call for an IV team or something like that. We start all of our own IVs. We found that it saves a lot of time. And so we do all that. We get them set. And we actually are fortunate where we have two coils. We have an A channel and an old 4 channel for those people that are a little more Rubenesque or
circumferentially enhanced.
Anyway, they're large.
Ron, speak to us about what you do to prepare the patient for the substantial amount of breath hold examinations that they're going to have to perform.
The prep is the same, but when we start to scan, you know, we do our, you know, the normal locators, stuff like that. And then we do our standard, you know, 2, 3, 4. If we're looking for viability or looking for myocarditis or amyloid, we end up doing, you know, short axis. And then from there, just from those images, it dictates what else we do. We'll do some what we call triple inversion, if it's amyloid or myocarditis, to look for myocardial edema. And then we have our standard sequence where we do Siemens is haste, on ours it's just black blood. Look for, make sure all the great vessels and everything are where they're supposed to be. And then again, if we find out that they, on some of the sequences, that they have a anomalous pulmonary vein or something like that, we go after, we go ahead and do all that also. So they're not there. If you would come in, say you come in because you had chest pain and your troponins are elevated, and you had a sore throat and all, well, we do our myocardial setup, which is, you know, the 2-3-4 short axis triple inversions. But then we find something else. We automatically do those images so we don't have the cardiologist coming back and say, hey, why'd you miss this?
Well, this there's no right answer for this one, but just ballpark. What would you say the average time for ballpark for most of your studies? I know some are shorter, some are longer, but, you know, general average ballpark for a, you know, thorough exam that you do.
It used to be an hour. Now we're, because we're seeing so much and everything, we're now about an hour and 15 minutes for a complete study.
I'd say that's on the high side. We try to keep them under an hour if we can, because for the reasons you're intimating that it's just too long. But yeah, sometimes if you've got a complex congenital case or you have multiple questions that the physician is asking, then you may spend more time in there.
And it's again, one of those things that sounds like it, you may change what your plan is on the fly,
yep.
Correct?
That's absolutely correct.
With regard to specific pulse sequences that are used often in cardiac MRI, so you said for looking at the wall, for looking at what you said you used the triple inversion for.
Triple inversion is basically a cardiac fat sat sequence, so it annuls the myocardium. If there's edema, it's going to stand out bright because it has water content. If there's anything that adipose or fat content, it's going to make it darker. So you're able to find areas where there's a possibility of myocardial damage from an infarct or amyloid or any kind of infiltrate, sarcoidosis, anything. It's going to show up as brighter areas in that triple inversion.
Is that the one you use for, that's not the one you use for the delayed enhancement, is it, or is it?
No.
No.
Okay. So this would be a pre-contrast sequence?
No, it's no non-contrast. It's,
yeah. Well, that's what I meant. Yeah, it would be non-contrast or before you give them any gadolinium.
Right.
Okay. And then so that's that triple inversion. For looking for that, like you said, for things like amyloid or fluid. What about now for the standard multi-phase, the CINE type studies that you do? Is that a balanced gradient echo? You know, what GE would call Fiesta, Siemens would call
Fiesta,
True Fist.
Fiesta, and you know, under Siemens, they call it CINE, but. Yeah, it's the one where you get the myocardium, and the blood pool is brighter. So therefore, you get nice delineation between the blood pool and the walls. And also, if you get you tweak it a little bit, you actually see the pericardium real nice. You can see if there's any disruptions. We try to tune ours a little bit so people that actually had open heart, sometimes they have what we call it tenting of the pericardium, where they put the sternal wires in, they actually hook part of the pericardium. So you can actually pick that up.
And that sequence, just for those that aren't familiar with it, it's really become a workhorse sequence for cardiac. And one of the primary reasons is because of the really good contrast between the blood and the myocardium. And in the old days of a standard steady state gradient echo, that wasn't the case. But with the advent of the SSFP improvement to the SSFP balanced gradient echoes, for those that aren't familiar with this contrast, this is a unique sequence in that it has the contrast weighting is based on the ratio or the difference between a tissue's T1 and T2 time. Right. So with some tissues, their T1 and T2 times are close together. They don't have much signal, and that's the case, or they have a darker signal, and that's the case with the myocardium. For substances or tissues that have a very high T1 to T2 ratio or difference, you get a very high signal, and that's the case with blood and fluid. And that's why, you know, that's one reason why these things work really well. The other reason is that they are extremely fast. And in fact, on most vendors, and Ryan, you can tell me if I'm wrong here, but at least I know on the GE, you don't really select the TR and the TE. They're selected based on parameters such as field of view, receiver bandwidth, that sort of thing, because they're made to run as fast as possible. The TE is always one half the TR. So the shorter the TR, the better the quality. And I guess what I'm saying is that's one of the big benefits of having high gradient slew rates. And so for cardiac MRI, high gradient slew rates are important. Ron, Bob, any kind of feedback on that?
So you're exactly right. So when the old GREs, we were using echo times in the 8-9 milliseconds. Now we're here in the order of 1.4, 1.5, probably effective T1, T2 TEs are in the order of about 3 milliseconds. So at least 2.5 times faster. And your point is very clear that now the endocardial blood pool borders are so much more defined, so that in the end, the volumes that we used to calculate by gradient recall imaging or the GRAS that you spoke of are actually a little bit higher, and consequently the mass is lower. But that signal to noise, contrast to noise is absolutely beautiful. And so that is exactly right. That's the workhorse. We use SSFP, the steady state free precession. You can call it what you will, true FIS, balanced FFE. Any of the Fiesta sequence, you can call it what you will. Each vendor has essentially the same thing, but it is the prototype. And I thought that GRE was where the gold standard was, but we and others have shown that even the important differences there will change, for instance, ejection fraction, wall thickness, mass calculations, standardizations for normal based on the SSB calculations. That's what I would say that 60% of all of the cases we use in cardiac MRI are the SSFP. And I don't use GRE anymore unless I really need to look at valvular assessments. And we've now known long that the SSFP tends to underestimate, because of those similar benefits for the myocardium, flow characteristics. So the interval phasing is lost a bit in SSFP.
Well, my understanding is there's almost no flow information, really.
Well, there is flow information, but you have to, you're exactly right. The say no is probably too dogmatic. You need to, and we have done this, and others have published on this as well, you need to almost recalculate your threshold for what the intervoxal dephasing is. So if it looks mild, for instance, on SSFP, if you would then convert to a GRE sequence and test it out and do that in a blinded fashion, you're more likely to be in the mild to moderate range. So at least a half a grade increasing. But the faster the sequences get, the more this issue becomes a problem. And for those of us that really like to delve into valvular heart disease, that's one of the weaknesses of MR from the standpoint of being able to visually see it. But to be very fair to your audience, we have so many better ways to look at valvular heart disease and actually see it and calculate and quantitate it using, say, phase velocity mapping that really has become the gold standard for assessment of many different valvular heart disease, particularly mitral regurgitation.
So that the sequence you're referring to there is a variation or some offshoot of phase contrast or phase contrast acquisition.
It's using the magnitude information. It's using the velocity profiles and the change in magnitude of those velocities, knowing their position in space and knowing how the velocities change. There, you get a magnitude image and a phase image, and from those two, you can then calculate using the velocity over time equation and essentially calculate velocities. And if you know area, which you would measure as well on the magnitude imaging, then you can get flow. So it's a phenomenal way of doing this. But we use all those integrated, not to get too far into that, but we integrate all that to look at valvular heart disease, particularly because unlike echo and GRE imaging, where the two are really relatively close, paralleling each other, the SSFP does tend to understate the valvular heart disease.
Ron, from a processing standpoint, because this sounds like some of this, I'm sure, would be automated. Some of it's, offline workstation kind of processing. What component would you say percentage-wise, or I don't know how to ask questions. So you've got a cardiac exam. You're going to have some of the stuff that's got to be processed, post-processed. Speak to that a little bit. I mean, like what are you actually, what do you post-process? Is it offline, I'm assuming, on a third-party workstation or OEM workstation?
Where I work, where Bob used to work, the technologists actually do everything. We do all the measurements. We do all the calculations. So everything's done on a standalone workstation, so we can measure velocities. We can actually measure the amount of LGE. So say if it's a hypertrophic cardiomyopathy and they got a lot of areas to light up, with the software, we can actually determine the percentage versus the mass of the myocardium, the percentage of the LGE that's there.
What is LGE, if you don't mind me asking?
Late gadolinium enhancement.
Oh, okay.
It's the old delayed enhancement nomenclature that the SCMR asks us to refer back, because it's not always delayed.
Oh, okay. So late gadolinium enhancement. Well, that's interesting. There you go. Just shows I can learn something. So everybody pay attention. That's probably on the post test. Anyway, speaking of gadolinium enhancement, talk us through the concept of what's wrong with the patient, what's going on, and what does this enhancement show?
So we're particularly talking about myocardial enhancement rather than, say, angiographic, which I imagine most of our...
Correct. Yeah. Myocardial for infarction.
So the notion here is that unlike, a nuclear image where there's, for instance, interaction with the cell membrane and transfer passively through, say, potassium ligands, et cetera, in and out of the myocyte, these are in and out of the cell membrane. These are large molecules that remain in the vasculature, and to a certain extent, they get into the interstitium, but never do they ever cross the cell membrane, except in very rare cases where there's cellular edema and the cells implode after a myocardial infarction. But what ends up happening is that we're looking for relative differences in the distribution of gadolinium. So the wash-in, wash-out pharmacokinetics are such that in a normal myocardium, while there's when the gadolinium is getting into the arterial system, it will wash out relatively quickly to the naked eye within a minute or two, leaving no substantive visual fingerprint of an abnormal myocardium. But in areas in which there is lymphatic obstruction, vascular occlusion, where there is myocardial swelling, the gadolinium effectively gets trapped and its distribution and washout kinetics subsequently altered, so that there is a differential decline in the gadolinium signal, such that normal myocardium is expressed with essentially a normal myocardium without the T1 effect, the elevated T1 effect due to the gadolinium no longer being gadolinium being present, versus the normal myocardium where the gadolinium is washed out. So in a sense, in a nutshell, it's the signal to noise or contrast to noise, the contrast difference between normal myocardium, which is represented by this increased T1 signal, which we see as bright, generally indicating that there's fibrosis, scar, or just depending when you image, maybe even edema, but generally just scar, versus the normal myocardium. And so those patterns of distribution, location, the transmurality, the density, the signal intensity, et cetera, all those give us particular clinical clues as to what the pathology is, diagnostics considerations, and as we've shown and others have shown, that prognostic information. And it's become again, the workhorse. I'm surprised that Lon Simonetti and others haven't won the Nobel Prize for this work. Ray Kim, Bob Jen, when they were at Northwestern, really popularized that. But that's how the gadolinium mechanistically works. And of course, as you well know better than I, the different gadolinium moieties have different differential capabilities of showing more or less of this.
Well, so in the way I've always understood it, you know, bottom line is if you have a healthy myocardium, you're not, you know, you won't have any residual, you know, gadolinium, shall we say, but in the myocardium. But if you have an infarction and you have dead tissue, then the gadolinium kind of leaches into that dead tissue, correct? And that's what you see as the late enhancement, or, you know, delayed enhancement, as people used to call it.
I'd be a little careful about using the word leaching into it. It just doesn't leave. So the gadolinium slowly, but it gets in there slower than the normal myocardium, and it's markedly decreased in its transit time through that myocardium, leaving this signature, this fingerprint of myocardium. Again, it doesn't get into the muscle itself, doesn't get in the cell membrane, but it's stuck in that interstitium, that dense amount of paramesial fibers in which that bind the myocardium to each other myocardium. So there's a dense array of fibrotic tissue that sort of holds the heart together. It's in that area. And that subtends myocardium that, as you said, is infarcted and or distressed in some other capacity, if it's a non-ischemic cardiomyopathy. But you're looking at fibrosis and scar.
Okay. Does the rate, maybe this is part of what the new quantitative stuff is, does the rate at which it leaves, you know, hang around longer or not hang around as long, does that give you some sort of prognostic?
It absolutely does. And what you're referring to is a concept that's really little known in cardiac MRI, except in smaller circles, the early gadolinium enhancement versus the late gadolinium enhancement. Before we really knew about using T2 weighted images to measure edema, we and others would measure, that early transit time at, say, 2 and 3 minutes, or certainly certainly by 5 minutes, and comparing that to, say, the 15 to 17 minutes. 17 minutes was the optimal time that we had published to measure, say, acute MI. The difference between that, Bill, you're absolutely right, is a measure of the salvage index, the index in which myocardium is likely to be still alive. But imaging too early under that same notion suggests, and misinterpreting that would suggest that muscle's dead. But we know now that if you image that muscle like 6 weeks, 8 weeks later, that early imaging is overestimating the amount of dead muscle, and the late imaging is really what's dead. But that difference between the two, obviously the larger that ratio is, suggests that there's muscle that has been damaged, and the penumbra of that muscle is hanging on. And so therapeutics aimed specifically at the ratio between the early imaging at 2 minutes and, say, 15, 17 minutes is a work of great interest and clinically relevant to try to preserve that muscle that otherwise may die. So interventionalists use this, pharmacological approaches, trialists use this as critical pieces. But yeah, that we typically think, just to be clear, we typically think about it being sort of a single time point, but many folks have looked at this ratio and the relative differences between time as a important prognostic and, to some extent, diagnostic approach.
Let's talk about, and probably end up on, because we're talking about gadolinium, use of gadolinium. And Bob, you mentioned that there are different characteristics of the different types of gadolinium-based contrast. You know, the safety aspect, I think that's pretty much been settled. People feel that it's especially for vulnerable populations, or for people who are going to have repeat studies, as some of these cardiac patients may, that macrocyclic agents are typically preferred, generally preferred, over linear agents. But in the past, with linear agents, one of the big advantages in many MRI instances was the advent of multi-hands and its higher relaxivity, albeit a linear agent. And I know in cardiac, Multihance gave the ability, if you, and I think you guys have used that. Yes. So when you first, for example, from a just relaxivity standpoint, that allowed you to reduce the amount of gadolinium you would give somebody. I mean, some people are still double dosing some gadolinium agents for these enhancement studies. And Multihance gave you the ability to use a lower dose. Your experience with that, just from a relaxivity standpoint?
Well, I think the relaxivity is the issue that's so critical. Maybe not for infarcts. I'll be careful to say that. I think the saturation curves are such that different relaxivities may not make a big difference from one to the other. But where it really has stamped its role is on looking at more subtle findings, analogous to the work that you've done and others about breast imaging, liver imaging, brain imaging, when you can see two and three more lesions or larger, more dense lesions, and the confidence that you have in declaring one is a lesion or not, tracking these things over time is the same approach that we use with Multihance. And so having that relaxivity that may be twofold higher using lower doses, maybe better, to some extent, better stability, interaction with oxygen moiety, water moiety is better. All things that you speak of with much greater wizardry than I do are the reasons that we were excited about Multihance. And the fact that even though it was a macrocytic cyclic, and it was still a group two agent, we didn't know how to spell group two when we first started using it. Maybe that's because we're just simple cardiologists and not.
Well, yeah, let me correct here something, and maybe I misled you here. I said originally you started with using Multihance, but I think what you're talking about is Vuay, right? To gadapiclinol agents that are not only higher relaxivity, but also it's macrocyclic, and therefore higher stable. Is that correct?
Multihance, is clearly a linear agent, but I think it still has reasonable stability, even though it's only a single arm versus I think four arms with gadapiclinol, as the macrocyclists typically are. But yes, that's what we used Multihance, and we were somewhat surprised as a linear agent that, for instance, the NSF and issues really had not ever showed up ever in Multihance. So we felt not just comfortable at its safety, but also its stability. And when you interleave that with its incredible relaxivity, the ability to see subtle findings, say with these diffuse interstitial fibrotic changes that we might see in cardiomyopathies, it became our workhorse. And within weeks of me learning about this, we changed our entire process over to Multihance and did that way until about a year ago.
So how's your experience been with the newest agent, Vuay, which is based on the gadapiclinol molecule? Even having higher relaxivity than Multihance.
I just was surprised that you could get higher relaxivity than Multihance, but the data supports that it is. And as a very famous professor, Dr. Bill Faulkner, had said, if you put your wish list out, you can't ask for a better. It's now macrocyclic, cyclic. You've got a relaxivity that's higher than Multihance, which up to that point, I think was in competition maybe with Ablivar, though I think that might be the only one.
Yeah, Ablivar was off the charts, but it just stayed in the blood pool.
Right, but the stability, the fact that you can use lower doses of it, I think lower osmotic as well as all those had remained particularly valuable, and this has just caused us to pretty much switched everything over to Vuay gadapiclinol.
Has that changed your timing calculations or anything that you're doing from a technical standpoint? I mean, the fact that you've got a higher relaxivity.
Yeah, as Bob said, we have used Multihance in fact, I think we were the first ones in the Pittsburgh area to even go to Multihance, strictly for cardiac. And then we have tried Vuay smatterings throughout. People that have a little bit of renal issues, well, we go to the Vuay. And actually, we have found we're using a half dose. For Multihance, we use 0.15 millimole per kilogram. For Vuay, we're using 0.075, and it gives us it gives us almost exactly the same LGE pattern that we would expect if we used double that with multi-hands. So if we were giving you 20 ml of multi-hands, we're giving you around 10 ml of UA, and we're getting the gnawing is almost the same. In fact, we change maybe 5 or 10 milliseconds. That's it.
So it didn't result in you having to really recalculate how you do your timing and stuff like that.
No.
Well, I think if you did for angiography, yes, this would be an issue. But for what we're doing, for timing is not a critical issue in cardiac MRI for, say, LGE. Maybe for perfusion, there are some issues there. And then you and others have spoken about doubling or adding the same mixture, same dose by just mixing it with saline, for instance, 10 ml.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's a neat trick that, because you're using such low doses, you potentially could miss that timing issue if you're trying to do an aorta, and unless you have like a smart prep approach that, say, GE had.
Yeah. Well, I think then, and that's actually something that I think, people should pay attention to, looking at VUA, start there on that end. And your dose is standard dose by labeling is 0.05, and you're using 0.075, so you're adding another little quarter to it.
Right.
And because you were using 0.15 on multi-hands, where you're adding a half, if you will, to it.
Right.
So you're adding less, a little bit less to it than you were adding when you added the multi-hands. But I know, I've talked to people who tell me all the time that for other agents out there, for cardiac, it's not uncommon to see people doing 0.2 millimole per kilogram. Is that not correct? I mean, are people still doing that, depending on what agent they're using?
I think that's exactly right, that people are still double dosing. And I think that ACR and others have made commentary about that the days of double dosing and certainly triple dosing should be markedly suppressed. And I think the NSF considerations did a long way towards making that not happen. Now, as Ron mentioned, I'm no longer at Allegheny General after 3 years. I'm at WVU and Medical University down in Charleston, and we're using 0.05 right as it should be. We're seeing the similar value of what we would reasonably, by physics consideration, by relaxivity, see with multi-hands at 0.1 millimole.
Well, let me just ask you guys this, as we get ready to get out of here. It's been a very, very intriguing discussion, and I want to thank you both for being with me. Ron, do you have any closing thoughts, if you will, to the techs listening who might be interested in looking at getting into cardiac MRI?
Learn the anatomy. That's the most thing. And two, hogtie that cardiologist there so you can ask him questions. That is very important. And you have to remember, each patient is different. Learn from that. You have your mentors, your doctors, even your residents. The residents are probably going to less understand MRI, but by helping them understand some, you, in essence, you're going to gain more back.
Give them something on MRI and get something back from cardiac from them, right?
If I had to fall back and not be able to do cardiac, that would be my own demise. I really, really enjoy it. Maybe because of my past life in training and stuff like that. And Bob will back me up. I like to pay attention. I like to try to understand the physiology behind what's going on, the anatomy. I just feel that that's the most important thing. That patient is, to me, my focus at that point. For that hour, that patient is my responsibility. And Bob will tell you, I take it to heart. If I miss something, it bothers me. I will go back over that scan and see what it was that I possibly could have done different to just make it stand out more.
Great. Bob, any parting thoughts from you?
I could give you a parting shots forever, but I mean, I got into the field.
Give me one.
I got into this field when I barely knew how to spell MRI before it was becoming mainstream. I think every year we're seeing this thing improve, the abilities, the malleability of this field. I think the future is exciting as a technologist. I can barely count to four. So 4D flow is something I think we're getting excited about. You know, real-time imaging, the advent of low field is exciting. We spent a lot of time with pacemakers and ICDs. So there's some really creative things that are happening in the world of cardiology. And as a technologist, this is a very, very apropos time to be thinking about getting into it. So if you're a young student just trying to figure out what you want to do, and you have a brain on your shoulder, and you just don't want to sit back and play with TikTok or Instagram on your phone while the scan's running, be on your toes, become a cardiac MRI guy, and it'll change your world. And you go home interested and excited and want to read and come back and think about new ways. It's a beautiful world, and it's a fascinating world. I wouldn't change it for the world.
Gentlemen, it has really been a pleasure to have you both on here. I want to thank you, Ron, for joining, and Dr. Bob Biederman, thank you, sir, as well. We really, again, want to thank Bracco Diagnostics for their support through the Unrestricted Educational Grant. And thank you all again for subscribing and listening. So that'll do it for this time. We're out of here. You're just going to have to get over it. See you next time. Take care.
Thank you.
You've been listening to MRI Cast. This program is made possible by an unrestricted educational grant from Bracco Diagnostics.